Welcome to another episode of the Bakari Sellers Podcast. Today we have a special guest. And as I was preparing for this with my executive producer and good friend, Jared Lodeho, he said, just sit back, ask the questions and learn something today. I said, okay, well, I will do that. We have Josie Duffy Rice. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I don't have any complaints, at least none people really want to listen to. You know, we start our show in a unique way. With our first question, each episode, we attempt to allow our guests the opportunity to tell us who they really are by asking them about the arc of their career. And you're a writer, journalist, podcaster, and an advocate. I think it's fair to say you do it all. Talk about your first job after Harvard Law and walk us from that opportunity to what you're doing now.
Sure. So my first job out of Harvard was as a policy advocate at an organization called the Center for Popular Democracy. And a lot of what we did there was focused on local government, the belief that national movements can be built by local movements. And so when you see three or four different cities or three or four different places pass a law across the country, all of a sudden you have a national movement. And that's easier maybe than getting federal legislation passed. And what we did there was build a organization called Local Progress, which was focused on bringing together progressive local elected officials across the country. You know, like it turned out that working in the law was not really for me. So the main thing it did was teach me that like this was not the way I wanted to come at the work.
All these people with these law degrees that don't show up in court.
Yeah, no, haven't been to court, I think, except for a traffic ticket since I graduated. what it really did emphasize to me was just how much of people's politics and what affects their lives is local. And the kind of eternal focus on federal policy, federal politics, I mean, all of that obviously also matters and shapes the way that we see the world. But the people that are really affecting your life are your local city council people, your local county council people, your DA, your sheriff, your mayor. And so that really was something I kind of took with me throughout the rest of my career, beyond just sort of doing this policy work.
I mean, that interconnectivity of policy, and we stress all the time that you're more likely to get the change that affects your life at the local city council than you are at 1600 Pennsylvania all the time.
Exactly.
So look, I took the fool's gold last time. There's talk again about Senator Tim Scott leading an effort to reignite the conversations in Washington around the George Floyd policing legislation. Based on the work you do, do you ever think that we'll see meaningful federal legislation on police reform? Or reforming the police, or better yet, can American policing be reformed? We probably want to start with a question first.
I think that American policing probably cannot be reformed. I mean, part of me wants to say that I believe in any change and that I believe the possibility for change. And so I guess I don't negate the possibility of American police reform, or I don't totally reject it. But I reject it probably about 99%. I mean, I think that American policing culture, I think that policy is born of culture, right? And that the culture we have in this country is one where policing is really not subject to any sort of meaningful democratic reform, that we, have built kind of a culture of resentment and antagonism among police in this country, and that policing is born out of racist institutions. It's born out of monitoring people's behaviors, not really for safety, but for control. So it's hard for me to see how policing changes. However, I also believe in harm reduction. And so I think when you address some of the problems with policing, even if it doesn't fundamentally change the structure, you're moving in a better direction, right? And so I don't think that the fact that I'm skeptical of overhauling the whole system means that you don't do anything to fix the problems we see. I just don't think we should expect that to do everything.
And so do we expect Tim Scott to be successful? How does that work from your purview?
Do I expect Tim Scott to be successful? you know, what I expect is that federal legislation to deal with policing, well, again, federal powers around policing are pretty minimal to begin with. And so it's hard for me to see how this really creates the change we want. I think that the legislation that ends up getting passed ends up always getting watered down to a point that it feels almost meaningless. And ultimately, I think that this is, again, about culture change. So I guess it sort of depends on how you define success. Like, do I think it's possible he could pass this legislation? I think it's unlikely given the structure of the Congress right now, but maybe it's possible. But I just don't totally know what that means in the end, right? What that actually means for people on the ground who are subject to police brutality and some of the most harmful policing practices that we see.
Well, that's a mouthful. So there may be something, but it won't be worth the paper that it's written on.
It just, I mean, I think it's important to focus on the actual impact of things versus just the symbolism. And around policing, there's so much symbolism. There's just so much focus on what this says versus what this actually means. And so I am skeptical of the actual impact. You know, this is a very entrenched cultural institution. And so this idea that like you'll pass legislation and that's going to change the culture is a pipe dream, and it doesn't matter who passes it, right? It matters that like, this is not the structure that we've built, and it takes more than just a couple pieces of legislation to undo it. So I guess that, I don't know, that's not-
That fully answers the question, because we've given them the body cams, we've given them the resources, we've given them the training and more cops, and we're still seeing things like Nichols in Memphis. And so I think your point is dead on. Let's talk about your new podcast, Unreformed: The Story of the Alabama Industrial School for Negro Children. What's it about? And why is it important that we know the story of the Alabama Industry School for Negro Children?
Yeah, Alabama Industrial School. Yeah.
Oh, industrial. I said it right the first time in Malden.
Yeah, exactly. So the Alabama Industrial School for Negro Children was a juvenile reform institution in Alabama that, as you can tell from the name, was created for Black kids. It was created by a Black woman who went to Tuskegee in the early 1900s. It sort of started out as a safe haven for Black children, and it became, once it was taken over by the state of Alabama in 1911, it became this just hellhole, this torture factory, basically, for Black kids. And it was functionally just a labor farm, right? I mean, it was a way to generate revenue for the state. It was a way to put Black kids away after the slavery ended. And it was a way to like really drive Black children into an environment of abuse, physical, sexual, mental, emotional abuse that shaped their entire lives. So in this podcast, we focus on the 1960s and we kind of follow four people who went to this institution as when they were kids. One of them went as young as 11. I think the oldest was 15 when she went, but you know, they were there as children and what happened to them throughout their lives. One of them becomes a very famous artist. His name is Lonnie Hawley. He's a very famous self-taught artist whose work has been in museums across the country. Others, you know, end up in and out of prison and trying to kind of navigate this just an enormously harmful experience they went through. But we look at what happened in the 1960s when one of these four people ran away from the institution and showed up at a juvenile detention center and asked to speak to someone in charge because she wanted to tell them what was going on. The white guy who she told became a whistleblower. It set off a federal lawsuit. It's set off a lot of changes at the school. But this kind of gets back to what we were talking about before, right? A lot of what we're exploring is what is culture and what is policy? Mm-hmm. Because we see some policy shifts at the school after this whistleblowing event happens in the late 1960s. But what we're really trying to figure out is, did the school really change? And what happens to the kids who come out of it?
This episode is brought to you by Max. The new HBO original limited series, The Sympathizer, is an espionage thriller and cross-culture satire that follows a communist spy during the final days of the Vietnam War and his new life as a refugee in Los Angeles. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr. and based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Sympathizer is streaming now exclusively on Max. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, Can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client.
How did you first learn about this? And what was it about this story that made you want to create a podcast, something that we could all consume around it?
Yeah, so I first learned about it from a woman named Virginia Prescott, who runs a podcast company called School of Humans. She was connected to Lonnie Hawley, the artist I just mentioned, and she had heard him discuss over the years this horrible experience he went through as a kid, and she saw how it really still affected him. I mean, you know, this still brings these adults, these almost elderly adults, right, to tears to talk about what they went through. At this school. And so that kind of pulled me into the story. And the reason it interested me is because I work in criminal justice and I'm interested in how we deal with children who have been accused of wrongdoing and how we think about disciplining children and how that discipline shapes the rest of their lives. So for me, this entire story is really interesting. But what really pulled me in was when Virginia said to me that lots of the kids who had gone to the school in the 60s had ended up serving life without parole sentences, or they are on death row. That there was kind of this, I mean, when we talk about school to prison pipeline, I mean, to the extreme, right? And these were kids who went into the school for loitering or, you know, being out past curfew.
Where is the school? Where was the school?
Outside of Montgomery, Alabama. Okay. And so, you know, these are kids who went in for very small things. I mean, skipping school or whatever, like they got picked up by the police because they were out past 10 or, you know, and then that they ended up like many of them ended up committing serious harms that landed them in prison for the rest of their lives after they got out of the school. So I was interested in how the school shaped what happened to them afterwards, but also how state policy and state violence is directed towards Black children. I mean, the state really had a choice, right? They think these kids are acting up. They think they're delinquent or whatever. And you could either try to help them, you know, improve. You could try to help them like figure out their lives. You could try to offer them opportunities. You could try to make sure they had mental health assistance if they needed that. Or you could, you know, put them on what was functionally a plantation and torture them and see what happens after that. And we know how that story turns out, right? And so that was really what pulled me in.
I mean, that's a hell of a story to tell.
Yeah.
What do you want listeners to take out of this?
You know, one thing I really want listeners to do is witness, right? These are people who have never told anybody else this story, really. They've never talked about it publicly. Many of them have never talked to their families, and they've just been living with this. So it's really important for them to hear people say, like, we see you, we know that this happened to you. This wasn't right, you know? And so that's part of it. I think the other thing I want listeners to take away from this, ironically, is hope. Because what you do see is that a lot of the people who come out of this school, some of them really suffered for the rest of their lives, but others this shaped them into actually, they didn't turn into the monsters. They didn't turn into the thing that they had been exposed to. They became better parents. They became better family members. They became more empathetic. And that's not me suggesting that this was a good thing to treat these kids like this. But I think what I really, I think what's really important here is taking away just the endurance, the resiliency of the human spirit of Black people in the South, right? Like the ability for people to make it through some of the hardest times that you can imagine. So it's a hard one. It's a heavy podcast. We tried to reduce some of the heaviness so that it's not miserable for people to listen to. But you know, it's definitely like, it's not a comedy, right? But it's also not just pure tragedy.
Give me the format of it.
So it's 8 episodes. It's a limited series. Most of it, we spend kind of looking at what happened in 1968 when these 5 girls ran away. And one of them says like, look, I need to tell someone what's happening. But we also explore, like I said, the people who end up serving really long sentences. We also explore the beginning and the meaning, you know, how the school got started. And so we're on this coming Wednesday will be episode 4. And it's an, you know, this is not, we don't, this is the whole story. We're not like, there's not a cliffhanger. We're not like ending on 8 and then we're like, we'll tell you what happens in next season. Like this is, we tried to create like a one kind of product, one kind of finished product that really tells this story.
I mean, and you can say, Bakari, shut up and go listen to it. But let me ask you this question. What has the state of Alabama said about the facility and their role in destroying so many lives? Have they?
It's a great question. Yeah. And how about I say this to you? Guess.
They've said absolutely nothing. They don't care. They just don't care.
Yeah.
I mean, have they had to settle any of these cases? Have I'm sure the statute of limitations have run. Has there been any litigation around? I know the answer.
There hasn't been any litigation since 1969 about this institution. I do want to note this institution is still open. So it is open today. Right. And so I went there. I mean, I couldn't, they wouldn't let me in, but I, you know, did my reporting around the edges. And so, I think it's different today. I don't want to suggest it's the exact same institution, but I think many of the problems still exist. And what they've basically said is, look, we hope like you understand that we're not what we were, but there has been no apology from the state of Alabama. There has been no acknowledgement from the state of Alabama. There has been no like reparations from the state of Alabama, right? Wow. And so part of that, I think for these people who went to the school, part of it has been like, did I imagine this? Did this happen? And so the ability for them to talk to other people who say, no, that happened. That bench was there. That beating happened. He had that stick. He did this thing has been really, I think, important for them because the function of the state is to just, you know, ignore it and hope it goes away.
How can listeners find this podcast?
You can find it on any platform that you listen to podcasts. It's a production of iHeartRadio. But we're everywhere. And so I will also mention it's free. I thought people knew that. My dad said, how much do I have to pay for it? I told him nothing. He was thrilled to hear that. It is eternally available. It is available anywhere you listen to podcasts. And it's really for, I think it's for everybody. It's for people interested in whatever criminal justice or juvenile justice or the South, but it's also just people who like are interested in the history of America and the human story, because that's really what it is.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Let me connect the dots. So I want to try between Unreformed and your work on justice in America. So I asked DeRay this as well, but I always want to know why we haven't seen more attention paid to prison conditions and how much correctional facilities fail at their jobs than, let's say, police reform. We always talk about police reform, but we very rarely have a conversation about what happens behind bars.
Yeah.
How do we bring more attention to what happens once people actually are incarcerated?
I think the reason that's hard is because it's so much more opaque. It's so much harder for people to tell those stories. Like you know, if you're in prison and you talk about prison conditions, like you pay a price for that very often, right? You don't have the cell phone footage in the same way. You don't have kind of the same sort of like public access to the experience. And also people think that people in prison are bad people. I mean, that's really one thing you have to like unravel, is that it's not the innocent guy necessarily, but this is not how we don't want to treat anybody like this. This is not what we want. This is not what reflects well on us. But I think you point out something really important. Like we focus a lot on the front end of the system. We focus a lot on policing. We don't tend to focus as much on the back end of the system. And it's truly, prisons in America are hellholes. I mean, they're nightmares. They reduce your life expectancy by decades. They're just terrible, terrible places that we are, you know, that is on our conscience as well, that's all of our responsibility. And so I think it's harder. I think it's a harder story to tell, but I think it's an important one. And I'm hoping, you know, as people pay more attention to the system, this is something that they start to care more about.
I'm gonna send you an article on some of the work we're doing here in South Carolina. Alvin S. Glenn Detention Center. I represent a guy who died from dehydration. You know how terrible that death is.
Right.
Second, how hard it is to die from dehydration.
Right.
After 13 days for misdemeanor in the shoe.
Oh my God. In jail?
In jail. Four people have died in the last calendar year. And we're working on, I just sent a letter to Kristen Clark last week about possibly and having a civil rights investigation. One I don't even know if they can do, but we're gonna try. And I guess my question to you is this. I mean, how do we pursue justice at a time in this country when mayors and other elected officials seem more focused on fighting crime than delivering justice? How do we find that balance? Because look, our parents, my mom and dad, your mom and dad, they don't want fewer police. They just want better police, right? Crime is a real thing for them. And I get it. I mean, it's a real thing it's something you feel. But how do we find that balance?
I mean, I think two things. One of them is that we are so used to focusing on punishment instead of prevention. And there really is a way to prevent so much of this, of these things even becoming issues, because we can ensure that people, we can create structures that make the necessity of prisons and police way less salient. I think that really is true.
Makes sense.
I also think we have to think about, again, I keep going back to this for some reason today, but this idea of culture, when you have a culture that is willing to treat people, to let people die of dehydration in jails, that permeates. That permeates in how other people think about crime. It permeates in the general sense of a community willing to accept crime. It permeates the ability for people to think about peace and safety as part of their lives. And so, you know, I'm a big believer that you don't meet cruelty with cruelty. That creates more cruelty. And so in a way, what we really need to do is ensure that we have humane systems, so we are teaching and perpetuating humanity versus cruelty. More broadly, I mean, I would say that some of this goes back to the Mount Meigs story. Like I said, right? There are people who went to Mount Meigs, who went in for something small. They were 8 or 9 years old and they came out. And, you know, one of the guys that we look at within months of coming out killed someone. A couple of years later, killed 3 people brutally. I mean, horribly. And it's the sort of thing where if you heard the story, you would think, what kind of evil person could do that? And he's not evil. He was in a hellhole for years, and that shaped him. And, you know, so when I think about who has suffered because of Mount Meigs, I don't only think about the students who went there. I think about the 3 people he killed, right? Mount Meigs is responsible in many ways for their death just as much as he is. What we teach in these institutions is cruelty. So it's not super surprising that that is what is, they're not solving the problem. They're, you know, contributing to it.
Yeah. Do you think we're the post George Floyd window for justice and police reform? Do you think that window's closing?
I think that things are very different than they were in 2020. I think that they're very different. I think that the conversation around crime, I think the conversation around race, there is always going to be backlash to change. And I think in some ways we're seeing a little bit of that right now. But, you know, and this is actually terrible, there's going to be another George Floyd. This is not going to end. We are going to see.
We just saw a man beaten to death.
Exactly. I mean, you're telling me that someone, you know, that's not a national story, that someone died in a jail of dehydration. I just saw an Arkansas jail where someone died of starvation. I mean, this is not a system that ever runs out of stories, ever. And so I hope that we continue to kind of fertilize ground, that we continue to kind of set foundation, that when something happens, that we can continue, you know, that we can do this again, that we can motivate people again, that we can remind people how cruel the system is. I don't think the window overall is changing or is over, but I do think that that period of the post 2020 George Floyd, the black Instagram squares, the you know, people showing up to march in the streets, people kind of being radicalized for that brief moment, I think it's not like what it was.
This has been a pleasure. And Jared was right. I did learn a lot from you. In fact, I've been having this conversation post Nichols about culture versus policy, and it's been driving me crazy. Mm. And you helped illuminate that. Yes, because I was like, there's not much policy you can do for this situation, right?
Exactly.
So anyway,
I mean, there's already rules. You can't kill people. And that's, that didn't, you know, like we already made that a law. And it's only sort of working. So,
well, I mean, you can kill people if you have qualified immunity, but that's a whole nother
thing. Right. Right. But that's also a culture thing, right? You know, like that you have to have a culture of a lack of accountability in order to even qualified immunity even be part of the conversation. And so I'm really thrilled to see the work you're doing. I'm going to kind of keep following this case, and I'm writing a book about culture versus policy. So once I finish that, when I'm like 87 approximately at this rate,
I've been on chapter 8 of a 10 chapter book for a solid year now. So
great. We're going to get there one
eventually.
Day.
Eventually. Anyway, thank you. My blessings to your family. Please give them my best.
Thank you so much.